Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You will receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here's a special offer to my podcast listeners. If you join the Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com and sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, I'll send you a free, personally autographed copy of my book, Gettysburg, and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com. Use the code FREEBOOK at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com, code FREEBOOK. This offer ends January 31st. On this episode of Newt's World, for Father's Day, we'll be celebrating with a discussion about our nation's founding fathers. I'm pleased to welcome as my guest today, Joseph J. Ellis. Ellis is one of the nation's leading scholars of American history. The author of 9 books, Ellis was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers, the Revolutionary Generation, and won the National Book Award for American Sphinx, a biography of Thomas Jefferson. His in-depth chronicle of the life of our first president, His Excellency George Washington, was a New York Times bestseller. Joe and I have known each other for many years. We're both historians, and both have a deep regard for George Washington and a great love for Mount Vernon. In fact, we had lunch together at Mount Vernon just over a year ago. I'm pleased to welcome him as my guest. I don't know anybody who has studied the key figures of the American Revolution and the founding of America from as many different angles as Dr. Ellis. What got you personally into focusing on this period?
I got to Yale, and they got me interested in the 18th century and worked with Ed Morgan, who is a giant in the field. And I realized at some point in time that all these editions of the papers of the founders, Washington, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, and that the profession was going off in a different direction. The profession was going off in the social history direction towards Native Americans, African Americans, women. There wasn't really anybody making use of this record that was being created. This is the greatest record of a political elite ever compiled in recorded history. So it was available, and I dove into it, and so I've been scribbling away, I guess, ever since.
How do you explain this moment in time where somehow these people came together and collectively were so capable of developing a system that is still here over 200 years later?
It's a wonderful question. Alfred Lord North Whitehead, the great British philosopher and wit, said that there were only 2 occasions in Western history when the political elite of emerging empire behaved about as well as one could ever expect. One was Rome under Caesar Augustus, and the other was America under the founders, and most especially Washington. One of the questions I used to ask students is, I would say that the population of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania right now is about the same as the white population of Virginia was in 1776. Now, if we go down the street in Wilkes-Barre, do you think we're going to find George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Marshall? Do you think we'll find those people? And the answer is probably not. And so it's a indirect way of posing the same question you're posing, Newt. How does this happen in one generation? It is the greatest collection. I mean, I think, you know, the greatest generation in some sense is the World War II generation. They're talking about all the citizenry at that time and the people who served in the war. My father was in that group. But in terms of political leadership, this is beyond question the most creative and the most consequential generation in American history. Coming at the start was a huge advantage for them because they got to create the foundation. But how did this happen? And it's, if there hadn't been a revolution, Washington would have, you know, been a country squire in Northern Virginia, and if he got into the British Army and he had applied and they rejected him one time, he would have at most made major. Adams would have been a country lawyer. Hamilton, who literally was a bastard, God knows what would have happened to him. So that they were all made by the Revolution. Revolution created talent. It called out energy that would otherwise not have been able to express itself. Part of the reason was that the American colonies were open to talent in a way that, say, Britain and France and most of Europe was not. That is, it's unimaginable that a guy like Hamilton would emerge as he did. He wouldn't have been allowed to have dinner party in London. So that it's open to talent. There's a high literacy rate in the colonies. In New England, it's over 90%. And as a result, there's like 158 newspapers at the time of the Revolution. There's a communications network set up, especially when the crisis with Britain begins to become serious and threatens to become a war. And it's marvelous to see the movement from top to down and then back again. Some people say it's an elite movement. Some people say it's a popular movement. The thing that makes it magic is it's both. It's an elite communicating ideas to people below and people below coming back with answers. And that's the basis of what becomes a republic. I'll tell you a story. Washington is walking out of Mount Vernon in May of 1775 to go to the Continental Congress. And Lexington Concord happened in April. And he's got Billy Lee, his trusted manservant, with him. And the guy that's going to run Mount Vernon while he's gone, Lund Washington, his second cousin, is coming out there. And he says to Lund, when the British come up the Potomac to burn Mount Vernon, make sure you get out my books and Martha, presumably not in that order. And he presumed by going to the Continental Congress that he was going to lose everything. He was committing treason. And then later, Lund writes him and says, there was a British frigate that came up the Potomac, and I sent out a little skiff with fruit and food to appease him. And Washington wrote back and said, I am extraordinarily upset with what you just told me. You have damaged my honor. You have attempted to appease the enemy. If it happens again, let them burn it to the ground. So that the crisis they're facing is an all-or-nothing crisis. There's no middle position.
Washington was incredibly tough psychologically, that he was prepared to live out the gamble of his life, even if it meant he lost.
Right. At the time that he was deciding that, the majority in the Continental Congress was in favor of some form of reconciliation. They didn't want to go to war with Great Britain, the most powerful military force in the world, the British Army and Navy together. He was taking a frontal position on this. They were saying, we don't want there to be a war. And he said, we already have it. Remember, there's a 15-month separation between Lexington and Concord and then the Declaration of Independence. And right in there early on is Bunker Hill, the bloodiest battle of the war. So that there's this long period from 75 to the summer of 76 when most of the colonists are trying to find a way to avoid going to war. And Washington is saying it's not possible. It's going to happen. Adams is saying the same thing at the political level in the Congress, that this is a cancer that can only be cut out and there's no way to cure it. They're ahead of everybody else and they turn out to be right. They're all in. So if you're running for office now, you know, okay, you're going to have to put a lot of energy and maybe spend a lot of money and do a lot of hard work and all that stuff. But you're not investing yourself in the full way that that generation was forced to do.
What are they drawing on inside themselves that allows them to behave like this?
At the end of the war, Washington writes his last circular letter to the states. And he says that we have two great advantages that led us to victory in the war and will lead us to greatness as a nation. One is this crisis developed in the aftermath of a broadening of knowledge that will soon be called, he didn't use this word, the Enlightenment. That we've come to understand how government works in a different way than the medieval people did. And we had the ideas and the architectural form for government available, and it, all we have to do is put it into practice. Not easy, but... And secondly, we have a continent that's separated from Europe by a vast ocean of 3,000 miles, and perhaps the most fertile land on the planet. This is our trust fund, and nobody's ever had this before. Now, he doesn't mention there's, you know, there's a million Native Americans living out there. He knows about that. He wants to try to find a just way to deal with the Native Americans. He fails in that regard. You've got natural talent that can come forward that would be blocked in other European countries. It's post-aristocratic, but it's pre-democratic. That is, they don't think they're setting up a democracy. They think they're setting up a republic, res publica, things of the public, or public things. Democracy is still an epithet. It means mob rule. So that there are an elite based on merit rather than wealth and bloodlines, a natural aristocracy, as Jefferson calls it. But they don't have to pretend that the people are always right. They don't think the people are going to be always right most of the time. Adams especially in that regard. So that they have natural advantages intellectually and geographically. They have a mentality that is located in an interim position that is, takes the full advantage of the aristocratic side and the democratic side without the liabilities of each.
You raise this interesting question. You have people like Sam Adams and John Adams coming down from Boston. You've got Franklin right there in Philadelphia, already a famous person and a unique person in his own right. You have the Virginians coming up. I mean, these are very different people from very different economies and very different cultures who don't actually know each other when this starts.
They don't. You're making a very important point here. There is no sense of nationalism at the start of the Revolution or even at the end. These are distinctive regions. The ordinary American doesn't travel further than 18 miles from the place he lives. Allegiances are local and at best regional. They don't think that a government can represent them that's far away. And so the coming together in a union to defeat the British is important. But once we defeat them, we assume we're going to go back to our own bailiwicks. And that's what happens under the so-called Articles of Confederation. What happens in 1787 with the Constitutional Convention, you can see it either as a culmination of the Revolution or a repudiation of the Revolution. The Anti-Federalists saw it as a repudiation because and this is why Lincoln's first line in the Gettysburg Address is historically incorrect. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. They brought together a confederation of sovereign states provisionally united to win the war and then go their separate ways. There's two foundings, one when we win the war, one when we become a separate and independent nation, the first large-scale republic in modern history. That's what makes it a political revolution. Even when Washington is elected president after the Constitution, we're still not a nation. One of the reasons he keeps trying to put the creation of a national university in the farewell address, and Hamilton keeps taking it out. Hamilton is drafting this thing, by the way, because he wants there to be a place where Americans come together and intermarry and to get them in, because it's what one historian called a roof without walls, where a nation constitutionally, but not in terms of real feelings and sentiments. And it takes a long time. We create the framework for a nation before we're really a nation.
Well, isn't that also part of the rise of Washington? And the major fighting is in Massachusetts. They need a Virginian to go up there as a symbol of the nation. But Washington is wandering around the Continental Congress wearing his Virginia militia uniform, the only person in the Continental Congress who actually has a military uniform, while assuring everybody he actually doesn't want to go and be the general.
You're absolutely right. He's wearing this uniform, and some people think that means he's campaigning for the position, it's really he doesn't have another suit of clothes to wear that really fits him anymore. John Adams is the one who nominates him, and you're right, they need a Virginian. Virginia is the biggest colony in population and in size. Remember, at that time, Virginia is what is now Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. And they also have land claims all the way out to the Mississippi in the Northwest Territory. So Virginia is huge. Washington was always chosen whenever men gathered in a room because he was the tallest man by far. The people at Mount Vernon say 6'2". I think he's 6'3¼", which is what they measured him for when his body was laying out to be put in the coffin. And he was 6'3¼" and 202 pounds. But the Mount Vernon people have done these elaborate studies that say I'm wrong because they bent his toes when they measured him for the coffin. I don't know, but he's big. The average height of a male at that time is 5'7", 5'8". He was 6'2 or 6'3¼", depending on who you listen to.
He was reputedly the best horseman in the colonies, which for a guy that size is quite an achievement. Governor Byrd, when they were in session in Williamsburg for the legislature, in the evenings they would all go down to the taverns, and Byrd would bet people a shilling that Washington could take a walnut between his thumb and his first finger and break it. But apparently, routinely, Washington would do that, and people were just stunned because it's, anybody listening to us can go try it. It's virtually impossible for a normal person.
That's a good story. I had forgotten that story. That's a less well-known story than the one I told. When I was on the book chat trail for Washington's, the book I wrote on called His Excellency, people wanted to know what he looked like when he was a young man, because all the portraits of him are from later. The first portrait we have is Charles Wilson Peale in the 1770s, late 70s, and then the famous Gilbert Stuart portraits. And the Stuart portraits are all iconic. That's not what he really looked like, even as an old man. When Stuart was painting him, he wrote a letter to his son saying he was looking at Washington's features, and Washington looked like the wildest animal in the forest. That's what he said. But he didn't paint that. Because he didn't paint what he saw, he painted what he knew you wanted to see. What did he look like? Think John Wayne, 1939, and Stagecoach. That's what he looked like. He was like an Olympic athlete and just physically impressive. Washington is, to me, the single most impressive of these founders because there were two foundings. One when we declare and win independence in the war, and the other one, we create a nation, and he becomes the first president. And Washington is the central figure in both. Without Washington, it's difficult to imagine how it could have happened. He was the indispensable man. In France, they get an indispensable man, but he turns out to be Napoleon. In Russia, he turns out to be Lenin. In Cuba, he turns out to be Castro. In Latin America, it turns out to be Bolivar. But that Washington is the one guy who could have become dictator for life, but he is an aficionado of exits. He knows his own power will increase if he steps away from power.
We were talking about Washington and about his willingness to have Mount Vernon burned, if necessary. And at the same time, he's losing, ultimately, as the war ends, he's losing people like Fairfax's, who've really been friends for his whole lifetime. Can you talk a little bit about this, the depth of this split between the people who were firmly committed to revolution against the British government and the people who deeply, and in the South in particular, I think, bitterly fought on the side of the British?
Well, Washington reached a conclusion sometime between 74 and 76, that the conflict with Great Britain was not going to be resolved peacefully, and that it would probably mean a war, and he knew which side he was going to be on when that happened. The Congress was divided at the time, the Continental Congress, and the majority were people seeking reconciliation. In Virginia, most of the wealthiest planters were themselves committed to not independence, but resistance against the British. So it's a mixed situation. As you suggest, the Fairfax family, whom he's very close to, eventually decides to return to London. and to some extent, Sally Fairfax, who in some biographer's opinion was the love of Washington's life when he was a very young man, leaves and they never see each other again. Washington is singular for very early on recognizing that this thing was not going to end peacefully. And while everybody else is trying to make up their mind, and there's certainly strong pockets of loyalism down in the Carolinas, especially in the western regions of the Carolinas and in the middle colonies in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, what distinguishes him is he makes up his mind early on and never turns back. He's coexisting in a world that until the summer of 76 is fundamentally undecided.
But even when the world decides, there's still a substantial minority on the other team, if you will, who are helping the British.
You're right in this sense, that at the end of the war, when the roles of the British and American army were made public, there were more Americans serving in the British army than were serving in the Continental Army. So that it is a kind of civil war. What's distinctive is that in each of the local regions, the Patriot side seizes control of the government and of the policing of the region by militia. And it essentially drives out the loyalists. There are totally 500,000 loyalists that leave the country over the course of the war. So it's a substantial population. But every time the British take a town or a city like Boston, New York, Philadelphia, when they leave, the loyalists have to leave with them. Because if they stay, they're going to be persecuted, if not killed. So that on the one hand, it's a divided population. On the other hand, the American side controls the power in each of these regions, and that if you end up deciding that you're neutral, you're not allowed to do that. They're going to stigmatize you. They're not going to let you go to church. They're not going to let you go to dances. They're not going to let you buy food, and you have to make up your mind. So that one of the reasons why we win the revolution is that the countryside is controlled primarily by the American side, except for certain pockets. Mohawk Valley, Western Carolinas, there's a lot of people, I would say a majority of Americans, just wish this whole war would end so they can get on with their lives. What makes Washington distinctive is he's there from the beginning, he makes up his mind, and he never changes it.
Why is it that almost spontaneously in every region it is the Americans who are better mobilized, more militant, and more capable of imposing their will?
That's an interesting question that historians have raised, and you have to look in each local place and to see how it's working. And it's the same story in most places, that the Americans control the press. They control 90% of the press. Every colony requires every able-bodied American between the ages of 16 and 60 to serve in the militia. The militia, especially in New England, are super organized and can outnumber anybody. And that the British can come in and take over, but when they leave, and they eventually have to leave because they just don't have enough men to occupy the entire country, the American resistance takes over again, and they punish people, sometimes severely, who have sided with the British, so that the population comes to realize that it has to make a choice, and the Americans control the political situation. Every particular colony remains under the control of an American legislature. If you're a Brit, like you're the governor, appointed governor, you have to flee. And they all flee to the coast and to British ships off the coast. Why that is, and your question is, why has that happened, remains a difficult question to resolve in the American colonies. Resistance was dominant. It had the energy. It had the leadership. And it never lost control of the countryside.
One of the things I wanted to explore with you is this whole notion that they have two really huge historical moments. One is winning independence, and the other is winning the creation of a constitutional republic. In both of those periods, the key players somehow managed to submerge their disagreements and their personalities in the pursuit of these very, very big goals, And it's only after they've succeeded with the second one that you begin to have the really deep, bitter falling out, for example, between Jefferson and Adams, but who had somehow managed to submerge all this for 20 years.
Your description is accurate. I've written a book on this called The Quartet. Washington, Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay are the people who essentially create a coup d'etat from above to force a calling of the Constitutional Convention. That's because for most of the Americans, the creation of a powerful central government is a repudiation of the values I thought they were fighting for in 76. We don't want a nation state. We want sovereignty to reside in the states, and this to be a confederation in which the states come together in this place. That's the culmination of the revolution, but it's one in which the anti-federalists oppose the federalists because they really think that this is a repudiation of what they were originally fighting for. Washington is the leader here again. He becomes president of the Constitutional Convention and is known, everybody knows he's going to be the first president. They would have never been able to reach any agreement about executive power in the debates in the summer of 1787 if they didn't know that Washington was going to be the first president, because they knew they could trust him with power because he was demonstrated he was prepared to surrender it. But that there are different moments, 76 and 87. One is top down and bottom up. The other is very much top down. I think if you took a popular vote among the total citizenry of the United States, and there's 4 million people, but only about 800,000 people who could vote, who were adult males with property, I don't think it would have passed in 1787. It wasn't a popular vote. And then the split that you can see in the convention becomes important, and the creation of the political parties led by Jefferson on one, and Madison on one side and Hamilton and Adams on the other.
But in that process, even though the people in Philadelphia are the elite of the American Revolution, they still have this instinct that they have to go back to each individual state and get their work ratified, that it would not have legitimacy if they didn't have at least some mechanism by which people could consent to move to this new model.
That's right. But I think that distance made a difference then. I mean, we didn't have cell phones, et cetera, and that most Americans in the late 18th century, they didn't think about themselves as Americans. They thought about themselves as Virginians or as New Englanders. And so the notion that there was this central government that should have their allegiance was something that took time. In some sense, the Constitution is what one historian called a roof without walls, meaning we created a national government before we were a nation. So Patrick Henry, for example, in the ratifying convention in Virginia says, well, what is this? Suppose the new government we're talking about passes a tax and we don't like it. We're being taxed without our consent in Virginia. Or suppose you order us to send our militia to some war far away, as they will later on, and send them to Canada in the War of 1812. We don't recognize that power. At the ground level, a lot of Americans are still thinking very much not as Americans, but as people with regional or state, as most state-based identities. It's not until you get into the Tocquevillian era, it seems to me, but, you know, 30 years into the 19th century, that the word American becomes a positive thing instead of a negative thing.
When we come back, the first four U.S. presidents didn't view the presidency as the great achievement of their career. So in the early stages, if somebody like Adams or Jefferson, or for that matter, Madison, becomes president, that is such a distant office that for most Americans, because they don't carry with them the historic weight of the guy who won the war.
The first four presidents of the United States were Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. None of them thought that being president was the capstone of their careers or the great achievement. They thought of it as an epilogue. Washington thought his great achievement was winning the war.
Adams thought his greatest achievement was leading the Continental Congress to the question of independence in 75-76. Madison thought his greatest achievement was the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson, I mean, he thought his greatest achievement was writing the Declaration. I think that both Jefferson and Madison think that their job as president is to limit government power. They're the first presidents to come to office saying our job is not to expand federal power, but to limit it.
In Jefferson's case, I tell people that I'm happy to be a Jeffersonian conservative. I won't do any more than sending the Marines to North Africa without congressional approval or buying half the continent.
Jefferson takes some of the most dramatic executive actions of any president in American history. I would think that the Louisiana Purchase, even more than Truman's decision to drop the bomb, is the most consequential executive decision in American presidential history because he gets half a continent. And he basically says, I know this violates my principles, but it's too wonderful an opportunity to miss, and I hope posterity will forgive me for the violation of my principles here. You can be a principled thinker, but when you're put into power and you're confronted with certain situations, whether it's the Tripoli pirates or Napoleon's willingness to sell the Louisiana Territory, you become a pragmatist.
I mean, you look back and you think, how would history have judged him if he'd written a letter back saying, it's a nice offer, but you know, I have this commitment to not doing anything like this, so maybe you need to find somebody else to buy it. I mean, people would think he was crazy.
Well, he was worried about how posterity would judge his use of power as excessive or not. There was a certain form of manifest destiny, even present in the late 18th century, even though before the term didn't exist then. I mean, think about the term, the Continental Army, the Continental Congress. The very language suggests that there was this implicit presumption that we're destined to occupy the continent, and that the Treaty of Paris gives us everything east of the Mississippi, south of Canada, and the north of Florida. There is this assumption, it's unspoken, that destiny does drive us into the control of all that land out there.
Well, and at the same time, it seems to me, you know, if you go back and you look off from Washington's first assignment as a young man to go west to what is now Pittsburgh. And Washington is always looking for land in the west. He's thinking about cleaning up the Potomac River so that you can have shipping to the west.
He sees the Potomac as the gateway to the west. They all think that God wouldn't have created a continent without providing a river system that connects it. And of course, that there is no such thing. And there are some biographers of Washington and some historians of the period who, you know, following a kind of Charles Beard interpretation of the economic factors that drive men, you could document that Washington really is quite interested in accumulating land in the West and seeing that as the basis of his fortune. Ironically, he receives the equivalent of about 60,000 acres because of his service with the British in the French and Indian War. And he knows that that land will become valuable to the extent that the population moves west and begins to occupy that area. I don't agree with the notion that that sort of one-dimensional interpretation of Washington explains him. It's a factor, but there are political and moral and ideological reasons that are driving Washington to become a patriot, and he's not just doing it for his own economic self-interest.
You mentioned earlier that how much of the Virginia landed aristocracy ended up being in favor of independence. Almost all of them had bad relations with creditors in London.
You're absolutely right. So did Washington. When Washington was thinking of the face of the British Empire, it wasn't George III. It was this guy, Robert Carey, who was his agent in London, who was purchasing his tobacco, and he thinks cheating him out of his livelihood. The entire Virginia planter class was in debt to British and Scottish creditors to the tune of $3 or $4 million, which is real money in today's terms, so that their motives for siding with independence were, at least to a great extent, economic. They just wanted to finesse the whole debt thing. In the Treaty of Paris, they're required to pay, but it's according to the treaty. They're required to pay their debtors, but the issue will be left to the states to decide how to do it, which means it's never going to happen. So, yes, Washington and the Virginia planter class is economically committed to independence for reasons that are very self-interested.
These are very proud people who have this sense that they're London contacts looked down on them. So it's both an economic and a sort of psychological resistance.
Washington was an extraordinarily proud man, and he applies for membership in the British Army, and they reject him. But Washington's response to the rejection isn't to feel that he's been condescended to so much as that they have made a mistake. They don't understand. The British look to the Americans much in the way they look to the Scots and the Irish, semi-barbarians. The Americans are not like that in the sense that they feel that they have an integrity and sophistication. This imperial presumption that the British bring with them. Franklin gets tried in the Privy Council and humiliated. And here is one of the greatest geniuses of the age. And everybody knows that. I mean, the equivalent of a Nobel Prize winning scientist, the greatest prose writer in the English-speaking world. And they humiliate him. British presumptions of superiority are at the root of a great many Americans' decision to go the other way.
Somebody wrote a brilliant study of the campaign in Massachusetts and made the point that the British Army had been very good in Wales and Scotland and Ireland because they had been able to sort of disperse the local levies without a great deal of effort. And all of a sudden now, they're facing organized militia who have been drilling and who are quite prepared to stand and fight, and that it's an enormous shock to go stumbling back to Boston, taking casualties the entire way, because it wasn't how it was supposed to occur in terms of the British arrogant approach to dealing with colonials.
You're describing Lexington and Concord in April of 75, but even before that happens, General Gage, who's the commander of the British forces in Boston, and he's the most experienced British officer in America. He's been there for 25 or 30 years. He's married to a wealthy American woman. Initially, he tells George that they'd easily subdue these people. He gets some recognition that he's really wrong here. After the passage of the Coercive Acts in 74, the militia really becomes powerful. And there is a false alarm that the British are bombarding the people in Boston, and the militia rally. Now, get this, 100,000 are coming from Western Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and they all head towards Boston. 100,000. They're just overwhelmed in numbers, and those people are organized. Later on that year, they send Colonel Leslie with a troop to Salem to occupy an arsenal to take the munitions away. And so he's got a group of like 100 British soldiers. He gets to the bridge, and all of a sudden, 4,000 militias show up and surround him. And he says, I have orders to cross this bridge and take the arsenal. And the American militia commander says, we will let you cross the bridge if you then turn around and walk back again. And if you don't do that, we will kill every one of you. So Leslie walks across the bridge, does the roundabout face, and then walks through these 4,000 guys back to Boston. They're outnumbered. They didn't expect that. And if they had internalized that lesson early on, they would have avoided the war. Because in some sense, it's a hopeless situation for the British Army. Because they are attempting to subdue a people who are numerous and armed. New England is the epitome of that, but it's true throughout much of the rest of the colonies, too.
But, you know, at the same time, Washington does not rely on a levee en masse to try to drown him. Washington has an instinct for order and for structure, so he wants a countervailing Continental Army. I mean, he accepts a smaller force that can be disciplined.
Throughout the war, Washington is in a position of pleading with the Congress to sort of support him in creating this professional army, and it's resisted throughout the war by the Congress because they don't want to create a standing army. And so that the level of support for the Continental Army, which almost dies in Valley Forge, 2,000 guys die in that winter. And so what Washington says is, look, the only way for us to win the war is to have an army powerful enough to destroy the British. He thinks, and there are demographic reasons why he's right, that if you give me what you can, I can have an army of 80,000. We can defeat them in a year. he never gets that. He never gets more than 12 to 15,000. And he says, look, I understand you're worried about a professional army, but that if we don't have an army that can sustain itself and defeat the British, then all these thoughts are irrelevant because we're going to go out of existence as an independent country. It's ironic. By the time the war's over in 1781 after Yorktown, the American army has become a professional army. It's hit and miss. It's improvisational. It's, you know, you develop officers. You find people like Nathaniel Greene, like Alexander Hamilton, like Henry Knox. These are people that are just discovered, and you build it over time. But the time when it can meet the British on equal terms is the time when it no longer has to anymore.
Just to branch out from that, one, you do get these moments when the militia show up in huge numbers. I mean, I'm thinking of Saratoga and of some parts of the Southern campaign where suddenly the British are just surrounded. I mean, they can't move.
That's right. Whenever the British army goes inland, it's at risk. Throughout the war, when they go inland and they don't have the support of the British Navy, they're at risk of being outnumbered. And that is certainly what happens at Saratoga. And the entire army of Burgoyne, is 7,000 troops, is captured. That's a real turning point in the war, too, because it brings the French in. One of the terms that starts to get used by the Americans is Burgoyned. We're going to Burgoyne them. But it's also true, Newt, that in many conventional battles, in the New York campaign, in Brandywine, in Germantown, the militia who are assigned to assist the Continental Army simply run away. They're not effective troops in many of the conventional battles, and Washington believes you can't rely on them. On the other hand, in those situations like Saratoga, where they rally from Western Mass, from New Hampshire, so that they just simply outnumber and double the size of the British Army, then they're decisive. The guy that knows how to use militia more than anybody else is an American infantry leader called Morgan.
When you look at all the material that's been gathered at Yale and you just sort of let it all kind of sort out in your head, were there things that particularly surprised you as you looked at the source documents?
You mean on the prominent founders now?
Or, no, just on explaining the Revolutionary Era and the rise of America.
Yeah. The thing that most surprised me, I mentioned it in passing earlier, is that the historiographic debate that's been going on for virtually 100 years is you have to take sides. To what extent should we see the American War for Independence and the Revolution in general as a top-down elite thing, or to what extent was a bottom-up thing? And that what surprised me is the obvious truth is both things are true. And that we shouldn't be arguing between ourselves about whether, you know, Jefferson and Madison and these prominent founders were most important, or people at the local level who really doing a great deal of the work and supporting the revolution. What makes the American Revolution so distinctive is that this communication system, it's almost before electricity, it's this electrical connection between the top and the bottom. The word democracy is still an epithet in the late 18th century. It means mob rule, but there is an inherently democratic feature to it and an inherently elitist feature to it. And what makes it distinctive is the combination. It's a post-aristocratic phase, but a pre-democratic phase that enjoys the energy of both traditions. That's the thing that most surprised me.
But isn't that, in a sense, precisely what the Roman Republic at its peak would have argued was the magic, that you had to have a mechanism which bound together the top and the bottom while recognizing that there might be an elite making the decisions, but they had to always be aware of where their strength and their power ultimately came from?
Gibbons' first volume of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is published in 1776, actually calls attention to that very fact. And here's a guy, Gibbon, who's sitting in the House of Commons and watching the debate about, you know, the future of the British Empire, and doesn't do much. He sits as a backbencher. The British could have learned a great deal from the Roman Empire. Augustus becomes a great emperor because he recognizes he can't try to control what is now Britain or even France, and he needs to give local control to those folks. In some ways, I think that while Gibbon doesn't bring his insights to the British situation, in some sense, his recognition of the mistakes the British are making is what informs his discussion of Rome under Augustus.
The founding fathers were relatively conscious of the theory of the Roman Republic. And I think they also, to go back to your earlier point about a standing army, I think they also had been deeply shaken by Cromwell and the English Civil War, and that had imprinted deeply on the Whig tradition that you simply couldn't have a strong army because that would lead to a dictatorship. And I think there was genuine fear that Washington might be the new Cromwell, which is why his giving up power is so vitally important in Maryland at the end of the war, because it reassures people, oh, he's not Cromwell. He's not going to use his fame and his military power to be a dictator. But I think this whole fear of Cromwell is really driven deep into the American psyche.
Washington, in some ways, the greatest thing he ever did was surrender power. That's what makes him an exceptional and truly irreplaceable figure in the American story. If you don't have a Washington in the story in the late 18th century, I don't think it turns out the same way.
When he heard what Washington had done, George III said, if that is true, he would be the greatest man of the century.
That's correct. There was an artist, Benjamin West, who's painting his picture. He's an American artist. West says to George III, by the way, the word is that Washington has refused the crown. And that's exactly what George III then said. Yes, if it's true, he will be the greatest man in the world. Washington steps down after the second term, right? He retires again. And then when the election of 1800 occurs, Adams is defeated and Jefferson is elected in a fundamental transferal of power. In any other country in the world, that would have produced chaos. But they accept the result of the election. It's the first peaceful transition of power in a republic in the modern era. There is a different attitude in the United States that gets established at the founding. We've never had a moment in American history to date in which someone has defied an election result and insisted on retaining office.
Parallel to that, weren't there some people who sort of wished Washington would become not dictator, but king, because they were just comfortable with the king as leader?
I think that the anti-monarchy ethos was so potent in the United States that anybody who had tried to assume that level of dictatorial power would have eventually been thrown out and probably killed. That's what Adams said later on when people asked him when he was an old man, what would have happened if Washington tried to, and he said, we would have gotten rid of him.
So when there was this sense, which I guess is part of the radicalism of the Declaration of Independence, that they are breaking with the whole concept of the divine right of government.
That's what makes it a revolution.
And they really meant it. I mean, I think that's sort of what you're saying, that they would have said to Washington, remember that document we signed?
It is both an ideological revolution and a movement from a divine right, top-down government to a bottom-up Republican form of government. But it's also something that has roots in the colonial experience that nothing in Europe can quite match.
Next, Joe Ellis explains what surprised him most in his research about the Founding Fathers. If you took the five or six key players, do you have a favorite anecdote about each one that you think sort of illustrates their personality or the essence of their being?
Franklin is the wisest of them all. He's the grandfather amongst the fathers. Read the pamphlet he wrote just before he left England to come back to America, Rules by Which a Great Empire May Be Reduced to a Small One, which is a kind of marvelous parody on what the British are doing, a wit. Combination of Einstein and Mark Twain. Jefferson is the most intellectually sophisticated, I think, in terms of the range of his thinking. The thing that leaps into my mind at this moment is a letter he writes in 1816 when being asked by a fellow Virginian about how his generation will be remembered and how they'll be canonized in the future. He says, we all want to be remembered, but we don't want to be canonized.
you're on your own. Each generation is on its own. And if you try to imitate us down to the letter, it will be as if an old man tries to put on the coat he was wearing as a young boy. Adams, in some ways, is one of my favorites because he tells you most about what he's feeling as well as what he's thinking. The quotation I might have used earlier with you is that, if I can ever be shown that there is no life after death, my advice to every man, woman, and child on the planet is to take opium. Madison is the most politically astute or politically agile. He's not as quotable, but I guess the sentence about him is, if God were in the details, Madison would be there to greet him upon arrival. Hamilton is the brightest, the smartest. He would have gotten the highest grade on the LSATs. He's also the most dangerous in the sense that he did have monarchical tendencies, dictatorial tendencies. And his quote that is reflective of what he really believes, he said, the people, always talking about the people, sir, is a great beast. He's of that side. And those are the things that come to mind.
This has been wonderful. I really want to thank you for a great conversation about our founding fathers on Father's Day.
Thanks for having me, Newt.
Thank you to my guest, Joe Ellis. You can read more about the founding fathers we talked about today, including a link to all of Ellis's books, on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Grace Davis. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Pendley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock, Tim Sabian, and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network.